more momentous. Lunch was just right, light and breezy. Hi, Dad. Nice to meet you. And she didn't want to go through all the bother of changing it anyway. Her mother would have a fit. Ellen had never seen her so tightly wound up about anything, and that was saying something, because her mother's natural state was uptight, as if everything depended on this one event going right. There had been a lot of uncharacteristic dithering about the choice of venue. A restaurant had been booked and then cancelled. Another restaurant had been chosen and then discarded because she couldn't get a table with a view. When she'd finally settled on a Malaysian restaurant, she'd confirmed and reconfirmed the time and place with Ellen. Pip and Mel were on tenterhooks. Ellen's friends were demanding immediate updates as soon as she got home. She couldn't just casually change it. "This lunch is a really big deal for me," said Ellen. "I know it is," said Patrick. He came and sat down next to her, placing the plate of crumpets on the table. He gave her a pleading look. "But your dad wouldn't mind if you changed the time, would he? What about Saturday instead?" "Your dad." His very choice of words showed that he didn't understand the enormity of this meeting. She wasn't just having lunch with her dad in the same casual way that he would have lunch at the local shopping center with his own sweet father. "Well, why can't you change your lunch with Colleen's family?" Ellen kept her voice neutral and pleasant. "This should be easy. This was just negotiating timing. This was the sort of thing that might lead to conflict with other couples, but not with someone as emotionally evolved as her." Patrick winced and scratched the side of his jaw. "It's just that this is when we always meet, the last Sunday of the month. Even when Colleen was alive, it's a tradition. It's never changed. Her parents are quite old and conservative. They like things done a certain way. Also, I sort of..." He looked shamefaced and put down his crumpet. "I sort of told them you were coming. This is huge for them. It's huge for me. I've never introduced another woman to them. It'll be hard for them. They'll feel like you're replacing Colleen. They're still grieving, of course. You never get over the loss of a child, but they're really keen to meet you." Millie said, "Ellen is going to be part of Jack's life, so we want her to be part of our life too." Patrick shook his head in an amazed sort of way and gave Ellen a sad, sentimental smile as if she would be equally amazed by Millie's bravery. Ellen felt a surge of resentment against everyone. She didn't particularly want to meet the strange man who was her father this weekend. She didn't particularly want to meet Patrick's dead wife's family. How could she not feel guilty for being alive when their only beloved child was dead? She was pregnant. She had never felt so tired in her life. Her hallway was crammed with stuff. She just wanted to be left alone to sleep and sleep and sleep. And while she slept, she would like Patrick to get rid of those boxes. That's what she wanted to do on Sunday. Patrick licked honey from his fingers. "Jack is excited about you meeting Millie and Frank. He told them you'd hypnotize them." "You told Jack I was coming before you even invited me?" said Ellen. "I know. I'm really sorry. I'm an idiot. I just had it in my head you were coming." "But I can't come," said Ellen. "But if you ask your dad..." "He's not my dad," said Ellen. She noticed her teeth were clenched together and made a conscious effort to relax her jaw. "I've never met the man. Please don't call him my dad." "Fine. I know that meeting your father is important to you, obviously. It's huge. But I'm positive that he wouldn't mind if..."
"I'm not changing it," said Ellen. "Just explain to Millie and Frank that I can't make it this time. I'll come next month."
"Is it that you feel awkward about meeting them?" "Because they won't make you feel awkward. God, they're even nice to you-know-who, and that was only a short time after Colleen had died."
"You-know-who? You mean Saskia? You just said 2 seconds ago that you'd never introduced another woman to Colleen's parents."
Patrick's voice rose.
"Another sane woman. She doesn't count."
Ellen's voice rose to meet his.
"She counted then!"
Patrick's face took on that look of controlled fury he got whenever Saskia's name came up.
"Why are you taking her side?"
"I'm just saying..." began Ellen.
"Forget it. Forget about Sunday. Forget I ever mentioned it. You're right. We'll do it another time."
He stood up.
"I'm going to get some more stuff from the house."
He slammed out of the kitchen without looking at her.
"Thanks for eating all my crumpets!"
Ellen yelled after him.
Then, to her complete astonishment, she picked up the plate and threw it against a wall. Everyone is moving. Jeff from next door is moving down the coast. The lively new family will soon be moving in. Patrick and Jack are moving in with Ellen. I'm the only one standing still. Tonight after work, I sat in my car outside Patrick's place while he loaded boxes into the back of his pickup truck. He obviously still doesn't believe in movers. I remembered the day that I moved into his house. He insisted on moving all my stuff. He got Stinky to help him while I looked after Jack. We went to the park down the road. There was another little toddler there about the same age as Jack, so we had to practice sharing. Jack thought the park belonged to him. The little girl was exactly the same. They both kept saying, "Mine, mine," while the other mother and I chanted those inane things parents say. "Share, play nicely, take turns." The other mother sighed. "This stage is just so exhausting, isn't it?" And I agreed, except, of course, I didn't think it was exhausting because I was giddy with happiness. I was in love with Patrick, and I was in love with Jack, and the three of us were starting our new life together. That night we had pizza and beer, and we let Jack have a piece of pizza, his first ever. Patrick took photos. He said it was a historic moment. Jack had the funniest, wide-eyed, blissful expression, like he couldn't believe he'd lived on this earth for 3 whole years without knowing about the existence of this extraordinary thing called pizza. He chomped his way through it like a machine. "I know, mate. I'm with you," said Patrick. "Just wait till you have it with a nice cold beer." "I was there when your son ate pizza for the first time, Patrick. I helped teach him how to share. I was there, and I'm still here." He didn't look too happy tonight as he dumped his boxes in the back of his pickup truck. He didn't look like a man who was getting married and having a baby. He looked sort of grumpy and middle-aged, to be honest. I guess it could have been the fact that he knew I was there watching him. I know my presence infuriates him, but I don't know. I sensed there was something else. I know him better than anyone. When he put the last box in the pickup truck, he came over to my car. I wound down the window and he bent down and leaned in and said, "Hi, Saskia." I was taken aback. He hasn't said my name in such a long time. Or if he had said it, he'd yelled it, as if even the word Saskia was something evil and disgusting. This time, he said it in such a normal way, like I was an old friend. And for a second, I was filled with jubilant, insane hope. "He's leaving her," I thought. "He's back. It's him again. It's all over." All I had to do was wait it out. But then he spoke, and I saw that he was actually angrier than I'd ever seen him before. It was like he was carrying a bomb, and he had to walk and talk very quietly and carefully so it wouldn't detonate. He said, "I don't want you going anywhere near Ellen again. Do you understand me? Follow me, if you must, but leave her alone. She's done nothing to deserve this." He was going all knight in shining armor, protecting his fair maiden from the dragon. Me. I was the dragon. "I haven't..." "The book. I was returning it." "The flower." He spat out the word flower. You'd think I'd left her a dead animal. "Patrick, I like Ellen," I said. I wanted to reassure him I wasn't any danger to her. The flower was meant to be a sort of friendly, even apologetic gesture. I wanted her gone somewhere far away, yes, but I didn't want to hurt her. "Don't," he said sharply. "Don't even talk about her. Don't, Jesus." He took a deep breath and puffed up his cheeks to blow out. I remembered how we used to say to Jack, deep breath, when he was having a tantrum and trying to learn how to control his anger. "Do you remember," I started to say, "when is this ever going to end?" Now he was using this fake, flat, reasonable voice. I said, "I won't ever stop loving you, if that's what you mean." He said, "You don't love me. You don't even know me anymore. You love my memory, that's all." I said, "You're wrong." He sighed and said, "Fine, you love me, but what's the point? I'm marrying Ellen." I said, "I know. Congratulations on the baby, too." His face changed again, and he said, "How do you know about the baby?" And then he said, "Don't tell me. I don't want to know." He pushed himself away from the car and walked off. I called after him, "Do you remember when Jack ate pizza for the first time?" And then suddenly he stopped and went still. And he turned around and yelled, Yes, I remember. We had some happy times. So what? So what? He lifted his palms in the air with his fingers splayed, and I saw his hands were trembling. This can't go on, he said, and he really sounded quite strange. This has to stop. I know, I said, and I sounded and felt perfectly calm. You have to come back to me. The plate Ellen had thrown against the wall was one of her grandmother's. It was part of a set that her grandmother had received as a wedding present from her own parents. Ellen loved that dinner set. If there was a fire, she'd run back to save it. She couldn't believe that she'd thrown one of those precious, irreplaceable plates against the wall, and over such a silly, trivial thing. It wasn't like Patrick had just announced he was having an affair. They'd just had a disagreement over conflicting social engagements. She did not behave like that. Imagine if her clients could see her. She knelt down on the floor and regretfully picked up the broken pieces. I'm sorry, Grandma, she said out loud. That was really embarrassing. She saw an image of her grandmother in the spirit world. She would be busy helping out on some spirit world committee. She had always been a very civic sort of person, looking up from her paperwork to observe Ellen over the rims of her glasses. That's not like you, darling. I know, said Ellen. It's so strange. The phone rang. It was her mother. I just broke one of Grandma's plates, Ellen told her. The wedding present set. Those plates always gave me such a musty, fusty feeling, said Anne. I'd keep them handy for throwing against the wall whenever you have an argument with Patrick. Not that you'd ever do anything like that, would you? I guess if you two had an argument, you'd just meditate together or chant or align your auras or something. I actually did throw it against the wall, said Ellen. You did? Her mother sounded impressed. Yes, said Ellen. She was suddenly furious with her mother. And Patrick and I do not chant or meditate together, and I do not believe in auras. Well, not as an actual physical manifestation. And anyway, you don't align your auras. You align your chakras. If you're going to be cutting, at least get your terminology right. There was a pause. I didn't mean to be cutting, said Anne in a softer, placatory voice. I'm sorry. I thought I was being witty. Actually, your father, David, made a comment last night. He said I could be a bit sharp at times. Perhaps he has a point. For some reason, her mother's apology made Ellen feel even angrier. Well, I assume you're not going to change your personality to suit a man, she snapped. You drummed that into me from when I was 8 years old. When Jason Hood wanted to sit next to me at lunchtime, I told him that he couldn't because he might repress my personality. He said he wouldn't press anything, and then he blushed and cried and ran away. Anne giggled. Actually, I never said anything of the sort. You would have got that whole repression lecture from Melanie. I never believed any man was capable of repressing my personality, thank you very much. You might be right, sighed Ellen, although she was sure it had been her mother. That was the problem with having three mothers. They all got mixed up in her memory. She pressed a fingertip to her forehead. I think I have a headache. What were you calling about? Well, I just wondered if we could change this weekend's lunch. David and I have been invited to go up to the Whitsundays for a long weekend on a yacht. A 60-foot yacht, if you can believe it. Some friends of his from the UK are in Australia at the moment. Bankers, apparently. Very wealthy. By the sound of it, they're weathering the financial crisis rather well. There was an undercurrent of pure pleasure running beneath her mother's normally clipped, cool tone. It occurred to Ellen that this was a sort of life that Anne had always been meant to lead. Drinking champagne on a yacht, chatting with bankers. Next, it would be shopping in Paris. David didn't want to put off our lunch, but I said you wouldn't mind. Of course I didn't tell him that you were totally blasé about the whole event. It's fine, said Ellen, but she was hurt. Her father had got a better offer. After all, he could meet the daughter he'd never met any old time. And now she would have no excuse not to go up to the mountains on Sunday and meet Colleen's parents. Wonderful. Are you sure? Said her mother. You sound upset. You're not upset, are you? Because it was me who said we should accept the invitation. I know it was horribly superficial of me, but I have to admit it just sounded so wonderfully decadent, I guess is the word. Her mother's honesty and slight embarrassment made her sound vulnerable. She was never embarrassed. Ellen's heart softened. She took a deep breath. For heaven's sake, her emotions were skidding about all over the place. It's perfectly fine. It's good, in fact. Patrick had something he wanted me to do.
Excellent, said her mother. Oh, by the way, I thought you'd be interested to hear that I've had not one but three patients tell me they've lost weight through hypnosis over the last week.
Is that right? Said Ellen, not especially interested.
Yes, apparently they've been going to these hypno parties. They're all the rage in Sydney at the moment. They're like Tupperware parties, but instead of handing around plastic containers, they all get hypnotized. Then they drink champagne and eat carrot sticks, I guess. Ladies of a certain age and income bracket are going crazy for them.
Fancy that, said Ellen. Well, good for Danny. Although it gave her an obscurely depressed feeling. What was the point of stock-standard hypnotherapists like her when there were dynamic young guys like Danny shaking up the industry?
Well, I have to run, said her mother. We're off to the theatre.
Okay, say hi to Pip and Mel.
I'm going with David, actually.
Oh, said Ellen. What are Pip and Mel doing?
I don't know, but David and I are seeing the new David Williamson play. It's opening night. We've got front row tickets.
Of course you have, said Ellen.
I beg your pardon?
Nothing. Say hi to Dad.
Ellen?
Sorry, I'm in an extremely peculiar mood. I'm fine. Have fun. She hung up the phone and looked at the tiny pieces of broken plate glinting on the floor. Everything she had ever believed would make her happy was happening. She had a father and a mother going to the theatre together tonight. She had a fiancé and a stepson and a baby on the way. Why wasn't she in seventh heaven? Why was she feeling so skittish and irritable? It couldn't just be the pregnancy hormones combined with a simple fear of change, could it? She couldn't be so ordinary, could she?
Aha!
So you think you're extraordinary then, do you, Ellen?
There was an enormous crash in the hallway and Ellen jumped. She ran out of the kitchen and saw that two of Patrick's boxes that had been piled on top of each other had toppled over and split open, spilling their contents in a great jumbled mess across the hallway floor. She could see an old dirty sneaker, CDs that had fallen out of their cases, tangled extension cords, a travel hairdryer, Christmas decorations, a fry pan, a matchbox car, a bulging photo album that had fallen face down, an old dustpan, coins, receipts, stuff. As she went to pick up one of the fallen boxes, she saw that Patrick had carefully written miscellaneous on the side. She laughed. It was meant to be a gentle, loving laugh at her imperfect but adorable husband-to-be, but it came out an unpleasant, bitter-sounding bark, as if she'd been unhappily married to him for years and this was the last straw. Then she said, "Oh, please don't," as the bottom of the box broke and another flood of miscellaneous items crashed to the floor. She dropped the soft, dusty sheets of cardboard and stamped her foot. Her home would never be hers again. It was going to disappear under a mountain of rubbish. She scratched viciously at her wrist as an itchy feeling of rage enveloped her, as though tiny bugs were crawling all over her body.
This is an inappropriate reaction. You need to breathe. In and out. Imagine a white light is filling.
Shut up! Shut up! Shut up!
She screamed in the empty hallway. She looked about for something, anything to distract her. She bent down and picked up the photo album. The first photo she saw was of an impossibly young-looking Patrick wearing a puffy-sleeved white shirt with a blonde girl sitting on his lap. She had on white jeans tucked into her boots, padded shoulders, earrings with dangling orange feathers. Patrick and Colleen. Young love in the late 80s. She flipped the pages. Photo after photo of Colleen posing for the camera, presumably held by Patrick. Hands on her hips, pouting her lips, opening her eyes wide, smiling seductively. Ellen's 17-year-old self, the one who had worn a very similar pair of earrings when she was a schoolgirl, but would never have had the confidence to model like that for a boyfriend, responded bitchily, "Yes, you're pretty hot stuff." Her better self spoke up. "Ellen, what's wrong with you? She's a little girl. 17, and she's going to die young. Give the poor girl a break." She turned the page. "Oh, lordy me," she said, this time in her grandmother's voice. She was looking at naked photos of Colleen, her blonde hair slick against her head like she'd just stepped out of the shower. Without the dated clothes and hairstyle, she'd lost that faintly silly look that people have in old photos. Now she wasn't just a pretty 80s girl, she was a classic beauty with high cheekbones and big eyes. Ellen studied each photo, feeling both weirdly excited and slightly sick. Colleen had a perfectly proportioned body, slim and curved in all the right places. She could have been a model. There wasn't anything pornographic about the photos. They were innocently sensual. Ellen could feel the raw intensity of first love. There was one beautiful photo of Colleen lying completely naked on a single bed with her eyes closed, sunlight across her face. Ellen imagined how Patrick must have felt as a horny teenage boy looking at this gorgeous girl. Ellen had been perfectly attractive as a teenager, a pretty girl, but she never had a body like this. And now her skin was aging and her body was thickening with pregnancy, and she was filled with a feeling of pure envy. She wanted to be that young girl, lying naked on her bed with the sunlight in her face. And the truth was, she never had been and she never would be. "Stop looking," she told herself. "This is highly personal, private stuff. You have no right. It's disrespectful. Your reaction is emotionally immature. Everyone has photos of their high school sweethearts tucked away in old boxes. It's no big deal. Shut the photo album, put it somewhere safe where Jack can't find inappropriate photos of his dead mother, and go and research prams for the baby on the internet, or do your taxes or something." She sat down cross-legged on the floor among all the miscellaneous junk and kept looking. And as she did, she felt a strange longing to have a girl-to-girl talk with Saskia. "Do you think he's still in love with his wife?" she could ask her. "Do you think he ever really got over her? Do you think neither of us really ever had a chance with him?" She felt like Saskia would be the only person who would truly understand why she couldn't stop looking at these photos. Chapter 15. You'll never forget your first age regression. Flynn Halliday. "Describe what's going through your mind," said Ellen. Alfred Boyle, the humble accountant who wanted help with public speaking, was sitting in the green recliner, displaying all signs of an ideal hypnotic state. His cheeks were flushed, his eyes moved restlessly behind his eyelids, his well-polished black business shoes splayed outward. It was Ellen's second session with him, and she was doing an age regression. After their first appointment, it had become obvious to Ellen that Alfred's fear of public speaking was a full-blown phobia. He trembled and stammered just talking about it. It was having a serious impact on his life. He regularly called in sick on days he was due to give a presentation. Alfred had already regressed to his first job as a trainee accountant. When he'd made such a hash of a short presentation, his boss had eventually interrupted, "Don't worry about it, mate." Now Alfred was describing an incident in high school where he'd had to give an impromptu speech on the topic of music. "I feel sick," said Alfred. His voice sounded younger, not as deep. Even the awkward way his jaw moved reminded Ellen of a teenage boy. "I've got nothing to say about music." "Music. What is music even? Like, sounds and shit? I cannot think of a single word to say about music. They're all staring at me. They think I'm an idiot. I am an idiot." "Where do you feel the fear?" "Here." Alfred pressed his hand to his stomach. "I'm going to vomit. Seriously, I'm going to vomit all over the classroom floor." Ellen looked at him uneasily and felt her own nausea rise. "We're going to use that feeling like a bridge," she said firmly. "And we're going to follow that bridge to the very first time you felt that way." She was on the hunt for what was called the initial sensitizing event. "As I count backward from 5 to 1, you will travel back in time. 5, you're becoming younger, smaller. 4, you're following the feeling. 3, you're nearly there. 2, 1. Ellen leaned forward and tapped Alfred lightly on the forehead with her fingernail. "Be there." She waited a beat. "Where are you?" she said.
"Preschool," said Alfred.
At the sound of his voice, Ellen felt a cold shiver. It never ceased to amaze her when this happened. There was a 52-year-old man sitting in front of her, but she was talking to a small child. "How old are you?" Alfred held up his palm and tucked back his thumb.
Four?
Said Ellen. Alfred nodded shyly.
And what's happening, Alfred?
It's quiet time, but Pam is crying in the reading corner. She's really sad. I think I should cheer her up and give her a present.
How?
I'm giving her a present.
Oh, that's a good idea. What is it?
My snail?
Oh dear, this was clearly not going to work out well.
Your snail?
Yeah, I found it on the footpath this morning and I put it in my pocket. It's huge. And guess what?
Alfred's face filled with boyish enthusiasm.
His shell is hairy. I've never seen a hairy-shelled snail before.
What are you doing now?
I'm saying, look, Pam, this is for you.
What's Pam doing? By the expression of shocked horror on Alfred's face, it didn't look like the snail had been a hit.
She's screaming and pushing me away.
Oh, Pam, thought Ellen.
I'm falling back against the bookshelf, and it's crashed to the floor with everyone's Easter eggs we painted this morning. And Miss Burke is yelling like she's on fire, and I can't find my snail, and everyone is looking at me.
Alfred's shoes drummed against the floor.
Miss Burke is hitting my legs.
Bitch, thought Ellen. 4-year-old tears were running down Alfred's 52-year-old face.
Now I have to stand up in front of everyone and say sorry to Pam and sorry to the whole class for breaking the Easter eggs. And everyone is looking at me like I'm a bank robber.
Ellen wanted to march straight back through time and remove Alfred from the preschool and take him out for an ice cream. But there was only one person who could do that. She raised her voice. I want to talk to grown-up Alfred now. Are you there? Alfred straightened up. He cleared his throat and lifted his chin. His voice deepened again. Yes. All right, Alfred. I want you to go back to that preschool now and see your 4-year-old self with your grown-up eyes. I'm going to count backward from 5. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Be there. Alfred stretched his neck. Are you there? Yes. Can you see 4-year-old Alfred? Yes. What would you like to say to him?
It's all right, mate. Girls don't like snails. They're strange like that. You were just trying to help. None of it was your fault.
Ellen checked her watch. The session was running overtime and she had Mary-Kate McMasters booked for the next one, assuming, of course, that she turned up. Time to wrap up with a few positive suggestions. An image of Mary-Kate's sad, dumpy face appeared in Ellen's mind. She looked thoughtfully at Alfred Boyle. Mary-Kate and Alfred were both single.
Single,
they'd both said immediately with exactly the same resigned, well, what would you expect, intonation in their voices, when she'd asked about their relationship status for their intake paperwork. They were of similar ages. She couldn't think of anything else they had in common, but still, who could ever really predict the magical combination of personality attributes and backgrounds and chemistry that caused two people to fall in love?
So why not give them just the tiniest nudge?
The barest flick of her fingernail could roll them together like two marbles. What would be the harm? Before she could change her mind, she started talking. You've been carrying around the feelings from that day in preschool for a long while now. Now you can begin to rewrite history. The next time you run into a sad-looking woman, you may feel a strong desire to pay her a compliment.
Ellen paused. Assuming Mary-Kate was the next sad-looking woman he saw, how would she respond? Presumably not like 4-year-old Pam, but still, this was Mary-Kate.
Ellen actually had no idea how she'd react. Was this a crazy idea?
And no matter how she reacts, you'll feel good about yourself. In fact, you'll feel great.
Ellen hesitated. How far should she push this? Oh, to hell with it.
You may even find yourself asking her out. You'll speak clearly and confidently, and you'll look her straight in the eye. And if 4-year-old Alfred starts to get in the way, grown-up Alfred will take charge. You'll ask her out for a drink, tonight if she's free. To the Manly Wharf Hotel, perhaps. You could sit at one of those seats right out.
Okay, now she was getting carried away. She hurriedly finished off.
And even if this woman says no, You'll be filled with optimism and confidence and positivity, because all that matters is that you took that leap. Nod to show me you understand.
Alfred nodded once. His head had dropped forward toward his chest. He looked like a drunk who was agreeing that someone should call him a taxi.
Well, thought Ellen, what would be, would be.
She brought him out of his trance.
How do you feel? She poured him a glass of water. Alfred took the water from her outstretched hand, tipped his head back and drank deeply. Then he put the empty glass back down on the table and grinned at her. He actually had quite a nice smile.
Good, I think, he said.
He shook his head and chuckled.
Yep, I've always been such a hit with the ladies. Just what every girl wants. A hairy shelled snail. I hadn't thought about that in years.
A tomboyish girl might have appreciated the snail, said Ellen.
But you're not saying that was the cause of my problem with public speaking, are you? Said Alfred.
I'm not saying anything at all. Ellen folded her hands on her lap and smiled at him.
It's just...
What?
Well, it's so trivial. It's embarrassing. It's not like we discovered I had a past life where I was, I don't know, stoned to death by Egyptian monks because I gave a boring speech.
Egyptian monks?
I don't know. I'm an accountant, not a historian. Anyway, I don't believe in past lives.
Excellent. That was something he had in common with Mary-Kate. They could chat about their lack of belief in past lives. Perhaps they'd been skeptical lovers in ancient Rome.
Or at least if I'd repressed some really shocking traumatic memory from my childhood, mused Alfred.
It was interesting how many clients with perfectly happy childhoods longed to find something dreadful in their past.
The most trivial incident can be traumatic for a child, said Ellen.
And your subconscious retains those memories. That's what we're going to do at our next session. We're going to reprogram your subconscious. Alfred, you're going to be amazed at the new confidence you're going to experience. As she made this pronouncement, she leaned forward and locked eyes with Alfred. She'd found that her clients remained extremely suggestible straight after they came out of a trance. It was a good opportunity for her to reinforce the session with some waking suggestions. She looked at her watch.
Come on, Mary-Kate, don't cancel. This could be your destiny waiting for you.
She wrote out Alfred's receipt, and as she slowly led him down the stairs, the doorbell rang.
Yes!
Ah, that'll be my next appointment, said Ellen joyously, as if it was a magnificent surprise to have another client show up.
Oh, that's good,
said Alfred, who was probably now wondering if she had cash flow issues. Ellen opened the door to reveal Mary-Kate's unsmiling, dour face. Alfred stood back courteously to let her in first.
Hi, Mary-Kate, caroled Ellen.
Mary-Kate looked at her suspiciously.
Hi.
Oh,
Ellen slapped the side of her head. Quite hard, she was a terrible actress.
I meant to give you something, Alfred. If you could just wait one moment, I'll be right back.
My apologies, Mary-Kate, I won't be long.
Just, take a seat, both of you.
She gestured at the two cane chairs she had sitting in the hallway next to a coffee table with magazines. As she headed back upstairs, she saw Mary-Kate plonk herself down and pick up a magazine from the coffee table. Alfred coughed nervously and kept standing. He walked over to one of the prints Ellen had hanging on the wall and studied it intently like a serious buyer in a gallery. Ellen went back into her office and found some notes on self-hypnosis for public speaking. She also picked up a relaxation CD for good measure. Then she stood at her window and watched the ocean. Was she putting her toe across that ethical line again? They probably weren't even talking to each other. She looked at her watch. How long before they'd start to worry that she'd collapsed or something? She'd give them 5 minutes. 5 minutes that could mean nothing at all in the stories of their lives, or 5 minutes that could potentially change everything forever. Which will it be, Alfred and Mary-Kate?
Chapter 16. Do not dwell on the past, do not dream of the future. Concentrate the mind on the present moment. Buddhist quote on Ellen's bathroom mirror.
So I guess I should, that is, I mean, I assume you don't want, should I wait in the car?
They'd pulled up at the graveyard where Colleen was buried. Jack was in the back seat of the car, his head down, lips moving silently as he played with his Nintendo DS.
He'd played for the whole hour and a half it had taken them to drive to Katoomba. Colleen's parents had moved to the Blue Mountains a few years before she'd died, and they'd wanted her to be buried close to them. On the seat next to Jack was a giant bunch of Colleen's favorite flowers, yellow gerberas, that Patrick had especially ordered and picked up from the florist that morning. It wasn't like Patrick was buying flowers for another woman. A rival for his affections. A mistress, certainly not. And it wasn't as though Patrick had never bought flowers for Ellen before. He had, many times. Beautiful bunches. So then why was she even thinking about the damn flowers when there was nothing to think about? Nothing at all. No, I want you to come. Patrick turned off the ignition and unbuckled his seatbelt. He turned to look at her and smiled uneasily. All morning he'd been in a jumpy, skittish mood, laughing too loudly at her jokes, overly stern with Jack, and then suddenly hugging him to make up. It was as though he had intense stage fright about an upcoming performance. "I'd sort of like to introduce you to her," he said quietly. "Ah," said Ellen. "Is that too weird?" He put his hand over hers. "Of course not," she said, while silently shrieking, "Of course it's weird. Are you out of your mind?" Patrick turned to the back seat. "Ready to come and see Mum, mate?" "Just let me," said Jack without looking up, his thumbs moving rapidly. "Jack," said Patrick sharply. Jack sighed and tossed aside the Nintendo. "Fine." They all got out of the car. It was even colder than Ellen had expected, and she pulled her coat more tightly around herself. She looked about, as she always did now, to see if Saskia had followed them today, but there was only an older couple murmuring to each other as they walked hand in hand back from a graveyard. The woman smiled at Ellen. Since the book and flower incident, Ellen had only seen Saskia once, when she and Patrick and Jack were at their local supermarket. Jack and Patrick were arguing over breakfast cereals, and Ellen had looked up to see Saskia walking down the aisle toward them, pushing an empty trolley. Their eyes had met, and Ellen had automatically smiled because it was Deborah Vandenberg she first saw, a client suffering chronic pain who was doing well with her treatment, who had chatted and joked with Ellen, a woman of a similar age to Ellen, who reminded her a little of Julia, who could so easily have been a friend. A second later, she remembered the true, peculiar nature of their relationship, and for some reason her nervous system had reacted as though she was embarrassed and her cheeks had flooded with color. Her throat dried up and her eyes flew to Patrick and Jack, who were still obliviously discussing crunchy nut cornflakes. Saskia shook her head almost imperceptibly as if to say, "Don't tell them," and glided silently past. "Are you all right?" Patrick had looked around just as Saskia turned her trolley at the end of the aisle. "Feeling a bit dizzy," she'd said. Pregnancy was so handy in that way. She'd felt obscurely guilty about that ever since. It felt like she and Saskia were somehow in cahoots to deceive Patrick, but there had been no point mentioning it to Patrick. Ever since Noosa, his hatred of Saskia seemed to have reached a new, more intense level. Ellen was frightened sometimes by the look in his eyes when he spoke about her. The night she'd thrown her grandmother's plate against the wall, he'd come home with another lot of boxes to stack in the hallway, and flowers to apologize for slamming out of the house earlier, and he'd said, "She was at the house tonight, psycho bitch." Why had Saskia shaken her head at Ellen? There had definitely been something conspiratorial about it. But didn't she normally like Patrick to know she was there? Wasn't that the point? And if not, what was the point? Did she really think that Patrick would eventually take her back? When and how would this all end? Saskia was a puzzle Ellen couldn't stop trying to solve. Now Patrick leaned into the back of the car and pulled out the bunch of gerberas. He held them in front of him with both hands clasped around the stems, like a nervous beau about to walk up to his girlfriend's door. He gave Ellen a strange half-smile. "So," he said. Jack scuffed his foot against the grass and made a pow-pow sound through his lips like a machine gun. "Jack," said Patrick.
"What?"
"Stop it."
"Stop what?"
"Come on, let's go." Jack ran ahead. Ellen walked alongside Patrick, looking at the names on gravestones, and wondered if it would be inappropriate to mention that she felt sick. She longed for the little pile of dry Vita-Wheat biscuits she'd carefully wrapped in plastic for the morning's journey, and then left on the kitchen counter. She was exactly 11 weeks pregnant today,
and it seemed that the nausea, which up until now had just been like a mildly unpleasant background noise, had suddenly intensified. She'd vomited this morning. She never vomited. She didn't even like the word. It was horrendously uncomfortable and undignified, kneeling on the bathroom floor, bent over the toilet bowl. She wanted to cry for her mother, which was absurd, because her mother hadn't been much use when Ellen was unwell as a child, and would always try to comfort Ellen by telling her about the much sicker children she'd treated that day. Apparently, Colleen hadn't been sick for a single moment when she was pregnant with Jack. She'd played tennis every week right up until she was 8 months pregnant. She wasn't imagining it. Patrick was definitely talking more about Colleen since their engagement. In fact, she'd started keeping a tally in her head, and there had been at least one reference to Colleen every single day for the last week. She had learned that Colleen had put headphones over her pregnant stomach and played classical music to the baby every night. Ellen had wanted to do the same thing for her baby, but she'd gone off the idea now. Colleen had craved salt and vinegar chips throughout her pregnancy. Colleen had actually lost weight in the first few months of her pregnancy, which had worried Patrick. Colleen hadn't suffered any mood swings. Colleen had a completely natural childbirth, and so on and so forth. If Colleen had been an ordinary living ex-wife or ex-girlfriend, Ellen could have banned all further mentions of her. But as she was dead, and as it was perfectly understandable that having another child would be bringing back memories for Patrick of Jack's birth, and as Colleen was Jack's mother and he loved hearing stories about when his mother was pregnant with him, Ellen felt she not only had to listen politely, but she even had to encourage further revelations about the seemingly perfect Colleen by asking Patrick interested questions with a bright, loving, empathetic expression on her face. Frankly, it was driving her bananas. She loved Jack, and she loved the thought of him being a big brother to her baby, but she couldn't help imagining what it would have been like if Patrick had been a first-time father-to-be, if it could have been just the two of them, excited and apprehensive together. Also, the nausea didn't help. She'd known that the nausea could be bad. She just didn't think it would actually matter. Not as much as it did, or at all, really. Even though her rational mind knew that it wouldn't last forever, this awful, seedy, off-color feeling seemed to taint everything. When she thought of holding her baby, all she could think of was, how could I possibly look after a baby feeling like this? She's up in the far corner over here, said Patrick. Jack ran ahead. Patrick stopped and touched Ellen's shoulder. You okay, darling? He said, and his eyes met hers. He did this sometimes when she least expected it. He would stop what he was doing and really look at her, properly, his green eyes studying her with such intensity, it was like he was waiting for her to impart a crucial message. It melted her heart every time. I'm fine, she said. She didn't want him worrying about her nausea right now, hurrying her back to the car or whatever. You sure? Are you too cold? I'm fine. Well, it's just up here. They kept walking past grave after grave, life after life. Ellen had occasionally walked through graveyards before, but she'd actually never been to visit a grave of someone she knew. Both of her grandparents had been cremated and had their ashes scattered in the ocean from their favorite clifftop walk. Of course she grieved for them, but it had been gentle, accepting grief, simple sadness for herself and the loss of their company. Not the sort of raw grief you'd feel for someone who died before their time. She'd managed to reach 35 years old without ever experiencing a shocking death. She saw fresh flowers in front of one headstone and wondered if it had been the one visited by the couple she'd seen leaving. She paused to read the inscription. It was the grave of a boy called Liam, who was born in 1970 and died in 1980. She glanced back to the car park and saw the couple's car pulling away, the woman's profile only just visible through the car window. She kept walking behind Jack and Patrick. Her stomach began to churn, her mouth filled with saliva. At that moment, nothing mattered, not Patrick's loveliness, not even that poor woman's grief. All that mattered was this sickness, this awful, awful sickness. Finally, they stopped in front of a shiny grey headstone with an oval-shaped picture frame built into the top. The frame contained a black-and-white photo of Colleen caught looking away from the photographer, smiling at someone, Patrick,
her hair blown by some long-ago breeze, love in her eyes. For the first time, Ellen came slam up against the reality of Colleen's death. This beautiful young girl shouldn't be dead. She should be in the car with her husband and son, driving up the mountains to see her parents, pregnant with her second child. Or better still, she should be Patrick's living ex-wife, not quite as pretty anymore, making unreasonable demands about child support and access visits. That way Ellen could stay in the picture. And after all, she would have excelled at dealing with an ordinary, shrewish ex-wife. She'd be so tranquil and accepting. Patrick would have found her all the more attractive. The carved inscription read, Colleen Scott, 1970 to 2002. Beloved wife of Patrick, mother to Jack, and daughter to Millie and Frank. Life is not forever. Love is. Right.
That's my mum at my first birthday party, said Jack to Ellen, putting his finger on the photo. She's looking at me opening a present from Grandma. The present was a dinosaur jigsaw. I've still got that jigsaw.
It's a lovely photo, said Ellen.
And by the way, in case you were wondering, the dinosaur is a Tyrannosaurus, said Jack.
He stuck his hands in the pockets of his jeans and considered.
It's a pretty easy jigsaw. It's got, like, maybe 5 pieces or something. I can do it in maybe 3 seconds, or even 1 second.
We sort of talked to her, said Patrick, without looking at Ellen. A bit silly.
Of course it's not, said Ellen. She felt terribly, terribly sick. It would not do to throw up over Colleen's grave. She looked around. If worse came to worse, she would quickly scoot over to Bill Taylor's grave. He was of tender heart and generous spirit, so perhaps he wouldn't mind.
Patrick knelt down in front of Colleen's headstone. He leaned forward and kissed the photo.
Oh, my goodness me.
Jack knelt down beside his father and casually, without any self-consciousness at all, did the same thing.
Hi, Mum.
What was the etiquette here? Should Ellen kneel down too and also kiss the photo? No, surely not. She'd never even met Colleen. That would be entirely inappropriate. A handshake would be better. Perhaps the alternative would be to give the headstone a polite little pat? Lovely to meet you. Ellen imagined herself telling the story to Julia, who would be shrieking, her hand covering her eyes. The horror! The horror!
Patrick placed the flowers down in front of the headstone with a rustle of cellophane. He cleared his throat. Ellen breathed in and out through her nostrils.
Well, it's us again, Colleen. We're just on our way up to have lunch with your mum and dad. Your mum is making that chicken risotto again.
As Patrick spoke, his voice became more natural.
Remember how offended she was when you told her it was too bland? Now it's got so much garlic you can smell it as soon as you walk in the front door. It's such a beautiful day. We wish you were... Oh, and guess what? Jack's team won at soccer yesterday, their first game.
Ellen squirmed. He'd been going to say, we wish you were here with us, but then he'd remembered his pregnant fiancée.
We smashed those guys, said Jack comfortably.
They did, said Patrick, and Jack played so well. You would have been so proud.
You were watching, right? Said Jack. From in heaven. You probably have this, like, giant grandstand where everyone goes to watch all their different relatives back on Earth playing sports, and you get whatever food and drink you want, and if you've got more than one relative watching at the same time, you've got this screen that sort of splits in two, and you can, like, switch back and forth.
Okay, mate, interrupted Patrick. Anyway, Colleen, we've got other big news too, haven't we, Jack?
Jack looked blank. Patrick tilted his head at Ellen and said, The baby.
Oh, yeah, said Jack. Maybe Mum knows already if it's a boy or a girl. She probably knows, right? Like maybe she saw it coming off the assembly line in heaven, like in a factory, and it's like a baby factory, and Mum was there, and she's like, Hey, that's Ellen's new baby. You're going to be Jack's little brother, or you're going to be Jack's...
Right, said Patrick. So, this is Ellen.
He looked up at Ellen, reached for her hand, and took it in his.
Should I kneel down?
I should kneel.
But what if I'm sick?
No, I should definitely kneel.
She knelt down. There would be grass stains on her cream pants.
but it seemed the right thing to have done because Patrick's face suddenly filled with some complex emotion, and Jack slung an affectionate arm around Ellen's shoulders, something he'd never done before.
Ellen and I are getting married, and I know you'd be happy, Colleen, because I always remembered that day when you told me I had to find someone lovely.
Patrick's voice broke and he squeezed Ellen's hand painfully hard.
And I said I wouldn't, but I have. And she is lovely. She's so lovely, and she's made us very happy.
Yeah.
Jack banged his chin gently against Ellen's shoulder.
Oh, you guys, said Ellen, because she didn't know what else to say.
She could smell cold, damp earth and Patrick's aftershave and Jack's peanut buttery breath. Patrick's hand was warm around hers, and for a moment the waves of nausea receded and Ellen was filled with glorious relief. No, this was not an excruciating story to laugh over with Julia. Its very awkwardness and awfulness made it somehow essentially human. It was one of those rare, poignant, pure moments that encapsulated everything that was wonderful and tragic about life.
Today was the fourth Sunday of the month. That means Patrick had lunch with Colleen's parents. It never changed. We arranged our holidays around it. I only went once after we'd been together for a few months. It wasn't a success. It was too soon. I shouldn't have agreed to go, but Patrick seemed anxious to take me. He insisted, in fact. He seemed to be in a hurry, like this was something that needed to be done, to be ticked off some checklist. I got the impression he thought it would somehow be good for his in-laws. I remember my mother telling me that it was a mistake.
Oh, Saskia, you mustn't go. That would be too cruel, she said.
But like an idiot, I thought that Patrick knew best. And of course, Mum was right. It was terrible for Frank and Millie to see me with Patrick, to see their grandson running to me. They were still raw with grief. You could sense it as soon as you walked in the house, as though tears had a scent that pervaded the air. They both had the identical shocked expressions of people who had just a moment before been punched in the faces. There were photos of her everywhere. It was like a museum with one subject. Colleen. Colleen as a baby, Colleen on her first day of school, Colleen and Patrick, Colleen and Jack. I couldn't let my eyes rest anywhere. Although strangely, I remember not feeling any envy when I saw the photos of Colleen and Patrick together. I was utterly, idiotically confident of his love. It was the photos of Colleen and Jack that made me feel unsettled. The evidence that I wasn't really Jack's mother. After that, I always let Patrick and Jack go up to the mountains without me. And I always spent that Sunday catching up on housework or seeing a friend, or in the time before I got my leg problem, doing some exercise. I quite enjoyed the break, having the house nice and quiet to myself. It seems completely foreign to me now, the idea of enjoying time on my own, when these days I have my whole life to myself, and time outside of work is a gigantic expanse of empty space, an endless desert I fill by watching Patrick. Was I really that busy, happy girl? That girl who raced down the aisles of the shopping center after work, who prepared nutritious meals for a toddler and gourmet meals for his father, who went to parties and barbecues and movies, who had sex on Sunday mornings, who was just another regular member of the human race. That Saskia really does seem like someone else. Someone I knew well, someone I quite liked, but not actually me. I've never bothered following Patrick up the mountains on the fourth Sunday. I know where he's going. I know the flowers he'll take and the florist where he picks them up. I know how he'll stop at the graveyard where Colleen is buried. The day I went, he wanted me to come along to see Colleen's grave. I refused. I thought it was a completely bizarre idea. I said, if I died, I wouldn't want you bringing your new girlfriend to dance on my grave. He said, I'm not suggesting you dance on it. But anyway, Jack had fallen asleep in his car seat. So I said we shouldn't wake him, and I'd stay in the car with him. I thought it was about time he took Ellen up the mountains with him. Now they've moved in together, and they're getting married and all that. Now he's in a proper relationship, now Jack has a proper stepmother. I watched them from my car as they all came out of Ellen's house, looking like a proper little family. Jack wasn't dressed warmly enough for the mountains in the middle of winter. He was only wearing a long-sleeve T-shirt. I thought about calling out to Ellen, "Get Jack a jacket!" But I didn't. I've always tried not to confuse or upset Jack. Ellen didn't see me, but Patrick did. He actually held my eyes for a few seconds, and then he sniffed and shrugged and put his sunglasses on like a gangster at a funeral catching sight of the police presence. It was strange when I saw them at the supermarket the other day. I wasn't actually following them. I just happened to be there. It was a coincidence, sort of. I was in their area because I'd driven by their house on my way home from work, but then I decided to pick up a few groceries. I wasn't even thinking about Patrick and Ellen, which is a rare treat. I was looking for oats. I'd had a sudden craving for Anzac biscuits. I haven't baked biscuits in years. Not since I was with Patrick. He and Jack loved it when I made biscuits. Of course, when I got home from the supermarket with the ingredients, I couldn't be bothered to make them. What would be the point? Ellen was the one who should have been making biscuits, not me. Ellen saw me and then quickly looked away, almost like she was embarrassed or guilty, as if she was the stalker, not me. That's what Patrick calls me, a stalker. I got such a shock the first time he said it. How could I be a stalker? I wasn't some deranged stranger. We'd live together. We'd try to have a baby together. The only reason I follow him is because I want to see him, to talk to him, to try and understand. But perhaps, technically, that's what I've become. A stalker. Never thought I'd be 43 years old and alone. Never thought I'd be childless. Never thought I'd be a stalker. I shook my head at Ellen because I didn't want to upset Jack if Patrick started acting like I was a potential murderer. I try to be invisible when they're together. It's my own personal code of stalker ethics. I didn't see any point in following them all the way up to the mountains today. I don't like those winding roads, and also I didn't want Patrick speeding with Jack in the car. So I got as far as a freeway just to confirm that's where they were going, and then I took the next exit. "Have fun!" I called to the back of their car as it disappeared into the distance. And then the whole of Sunday lay in front of me like a malicious joke. As I drove home, I imagined them talking in the car. So much to chat about and plan. The wedding, the baby, what they'll all have for dinner tonight. I wonder if Ellen prepares Jack's school lunch for him. Has she slipped into the mummy role as easily and enthusiastically as I did? I can still remember the lunch I made for Jack's first day of school. Ham and cheese sandwich on wholemeal bread. A peach. He loved peaches. Little box of sultanas. Carton of apple juice. A buttered slice of his favorite banana loaf. I planned it so meticulously. Talked about it with Mum. "Did he eat everything?" she rang up to ask that night. "Everything except the sultanas," I told her. Patrick had no idea what Jack had in his lunchbox. Food doesn't really interest him. When you're responsible for a child, when your days are filled with the tiny details that make up a child's life, his lunchbox, his school bag, his shoes, his favorite t-shirt, his friends' mothers, his TV shows, his temper tantrums, and then you're told that you are no longer responsible, that you are no longer wanted, that your services are no longer required, that you've been made redundant like an employee, walked to the door by security, it is difficult. It is quite profoundly difficult. Jack must have asked for me. He must have been so confused. I let him down. I blame myself for my mini breakdown or whatever it was that happened to me when Patrick broke it off. I couldn't stay in the same bed, so I went to stay at my friend Tammy's place. Tammy. Whatever happened to Tammy? She tried so hard to stay friends with me, but then she sort of slid out of my life along with everyone else. I remember waking up in Tammy's room 5 days later and realizing it was Friday morning and that Jack had swimming lessons straight after school, and I always had to remember to pack his things the night before. And who would take him? I worked 9:30 to 2:30 p.m. I had rearranged my working hours so I could pick him up from preschool, and now, for the last few weeks, school. I was happy to do this. I had more flexibility than Patrick, and I loved picking him up. I was Jack's mother. I didn't mind when I missed out on a promotion because I wasn't working full hours. That's what all mothers do. They put their careers on hold for their children. So I called Patrick to remind him about swimming lessons. And that's when all this started, my habit, my stalking of my old life. because Patrick treated me like a stranger, as if Jack's swimming lessons were nothing to do with me, when just the week before I'd been at swimming, helping Jack adjust his goggles, talking to his teacher about maybe moving him up a class, making arrangements with one of the other mothers for a playdate with her son.
"It's fine," Patrick had said, all irritable and put out, as if I was interfering, as if I'd never had anything to do with Jack. "We've got it all under control." The rage that swept through me was like nothing I'd ever felt before. I hated him. I still loved him, but I hated him. And ever since then, it's been hard to tell the difference between the two. If I didn't hate him so intensely, maybe I would have been able to stop loving him. I know that doesn't make sense. If he'd just listened to me with the respect I deserved when I called up to remind him things about Jack. If he'd just sat down with me and let me talk and let me say how much he'd hurt me. If he'd ever just said, "I'm sorry," and meant it, then I think I could have let it go. Perhaps then I would have eventually healed, like people do. Instead, it got infected. It spread like gangrene. It took hold. It's his fault. I know what I do is unacceptable. Deep down, I do know this, but he started it. Mum used to say that when she met my dad, it was like a perfect love story. I thought Patrick was my perfect love story. Except he's not. He's the hypnotist's love story. I'm the ex-girlfriend in the hypnotist's love story. Not the heroine. I'm only a minor character. Or perhaps I'm the villain. No one spoke as they left the graveyard and drove toward Frank and Millie's place. Jack sat quietly in the back seat, absorbed in his game again. Patrick concentrated on driving the winding mountain road. Ellen tipped her head back against the car seat. The nausea was still there, but it was manageable, as long as she didn't have to wait too long to eat once she got to Frank and Millie's place. One dry piece of bread would do the trick. She watched the world whip by outside the window like a movie on fast forward. Quaint little mountain villages with cafes and second-hand bookshops and antique stores. She remembered a romantic weekend in the mountains with John in the very early days of their relationship. She let the memory slip away. He was getting married, so was she. Life was moving forward. She needed to keep her eyes on the road ahead. So did Saskia. So did Patrick, actually. She wondered if he was thinking about Colleen right now, comparing her with Ellen, wondering what his life would have been like if she hadn't died. If only she could read his mind. She glanced at his inscrutable profile. Of course there was a way. Most nights, Patrick still asked for a relaxation exercise before they went to sleep. It was part of their routine. He trusted her completely. She could easily take him into a deep trance and ask him to tell her how he felt about Colleen, and then use a post-hypnotic suggestion so that he would never remember what she had asked. But that would be wrong. Totally unethical. She couldn't go poking about his mind without his permission. It would be like reading his diary. And it would be unfair because he couldn't do the same thing to her. She wouldn't want him finding out that she still had complicated feelings about John. So of course she would never do such a thing. It was the sort of thing Danny would do to a girlfriend if he were ever in a relationship. She couldn't believe she'd even allowed such a thought to cross her mind. It wasn't like her. She was becoming increasingly disappointed with herself lately. She wasn't nearly as compassionate or moral or as patient a person as she'd always thought herself to be. But goodness me, it was tempting. "Dad," said Jack suddenly from the back seat. Ellen started guiltily. "After we've finished lunch, can we go for another bushwalk to that same place we went last time?"
"Sure," said Patrick. "Oh, actually, no, mate. We might have to leave straight away because I need to go back into the office this afternoon for a few hours." Jack groaned. "Next time," said Patrick.
"You're going into the office this afternoon?" said Ellen. Patrick glanced over at her.
"Oh, yeah, sorry. Didn't I tell you? I've got to catch up on some paperwork. I've just been swamped."
So presumably that meant she would be the one taking care of Jack. She'd been planning to catch up with Julia this afternoon. It had been ages since she'd seen her, and Julia was looking forward to hearing all about the visit to Colleen's parents. She could hardly speak freely if she had Jack with her.
"So I'm looking after Jack this afternoon?"
she double-checked.
Well, he's big enough. He doesn't need a babysitter anymore. Do you, mate? Said Patrick. He'll just do his own thing. Actually, you've got some homework to finish off, haven't you, Jack?
Ellen suppressed a sigh. Since Patrick and Jack had moved into her house, she'd experienced the pleasure of homework supervision for the first time. It was awful.
It was so hard to get Jack to just sit upright at the table with his pencil in hand and his books open in front of him. He would half slide off his chair, resting his cheek on the table like he was ill, or else he'd keep running off, disappearing on unexplained errands as they occurred to him.
She was still finding her way with Jack. It wasn't like he was rebelling against her or treating her like a wicked stepmother. He was perfectly friendly and relaxed with Ellen. She was the one who felt on edge. She noticed that her voice got terribly bouncy whenever she talked to him.